Okay, this is the place where I say turn with me, if you will, to where this week's Torah portion begins. We continue with some of the descriptions of the things in and associated with the Mishkan. This one begins, and that's where I want you to turn, of course, in the chapter 27 of Exodus, or Shemot, verse 20. And it says this, "And you shall command," and it goes in the Hebrew like this, Ve'ata tetzaveh. Tetzaveh. Recognize there's a root in there. Mitzvah is the root that's in there. Okay, well, that's got to do with commandments or to command. So, yeah, you shall command the B'nai Israel, et B'nai Israel, that they bring some pure beaten olive oil for a light to cause a lamp to burn continually. We're talking about the menorah, and the tent of meeting. It's going to be outside the veil, which is before the testimony. Aaron and his sons are going to take care of it, set it in order, and it's to burn from evening to morning before Yahuwah, evening to morning, so all night long, it shall be a statute forever throughout their generations on behalf of the B'nai Israel. And this one's kind of interesting. It does say statute forever throughout their generations. It's not happening right now, of course, and the obvious reason is because ain't got no Mishkan or temple or other place where this could happen anyway. So this is one of those things that comes up fairly frequently. Hey, you know, what about what parts of the Old Testament still apply and similar? Well, the answer is, he says, Do it forever. And here's another example of where that's exactly what it says. And yet, if you can't do it, well, you can't do it. Chapter 28 is where I think the plot thickens. And this is the place where I'm going to spend a few minutes and pause and kind of back up a bit, too. Says here in the first couple of verses, "You bring near unto you Aaron, your brother." Then Aaron is going to be Kohen Gadol, the high priest. His sons will be later on to follow in his stead, those that make it anyway. His sons with him. "For among the children of Israel, from among the children of Israel, so that they can minister to me in the office of the Kohen, the priests. Even," and here we're naming the four of them, "Aaron and his sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar," Aaron's sons. And this is the place where the plot thickens. Okay, sometimes I introduce it this way. You know, this is one of those Torah portions people say, oh, you know, it's kind of boring. It's just got to do with things like oil and with clothing and stuff like that. Gee, you know, do we really have to go through this again? And I'm going to try to do it a bit differently this evening, just to make a couple of points that I haven't made all that often. But I want to read verse 2 to set that up. It says here, "You shall make kadosh, set apart garments for Aaron, your brother, and for splendor and for beauty." And the word there that comes first is le kabod. And that's sometimes rendered as splendor. Some translations, you'll see it says for glory. Kabod, right? The glory of Yahuwah. The kabod. Okay, we know that word. And or for beauty. That's the other word that's used here. This one we haven't seen before. It's tifara. Le tifarat. Adornment or beauty. Okay, what's the point? Garments. Now, that word that I just mentioned, le tifara, for adornment, that's the first time that one appears in Scripture. These other words, though, the words that are key in here, set apart garments, okay, covering, beged is the Hebrew root word there. And I'm going to come back to that one because this is kind of fascinating. And the same thing is true about this idea of splendor and why these garments are described at all and what it means. And I've got two stories I want to do on that part before I go through the rest of the Torah portion here to kind of set it up. First, I guess just a little personal anecdote to introduce all of this, and that is that those of you that have known me in person can tell that I'm not what you call a fancy dresser. I'm not real big on fancy clothes. As far as I'm concerned, you know, spending money on clothes is kind of like the last thing I'd want to do. And it shows. I mean, clothes are for practical purposes. It's a place when you're working to keep from getting your body all scarred up and to hang your tools when you need it. And if you're outside in the wintertime, it's to keep you from freezing something off that you might want to have. All of that kind of stuff. So in other words, there's a utilitarian factor. But when it comes to splendor and beauty with clothes, it kind of goes over my head to some extent. And as I was thinking about how I wanted to approach this tonight, I couldn't help but hearken back to my days, my early days as a young engineer, let's just say a few decades back, when I was working for IBM. Now, some of you may know IBM had kind of a reputation. It wasn't quite as strict in those days as it was before, but it was still pretty strict. In other words, there were a whole lots of, literally year after year, when I went to work, and even though I was going to be out in the lab or doing any number of things, I would often have to wear a three-piece suit. I guarantee you, if we were going to give a presentation, if I had to get up and do a pitch on a new project or a design review or something like that, three-piece suit was the order of the day. They got a little bit less strict over the years. Didn't have to have a white shirt with the three-piece suit. We sometimes wore, can you imagine this, colored shirts with the ties. But anyway, the point is, I wasn't real big on having to do that or to spend money to buy suits, but at least I was getting paid, so okay, it was part of the deal. I do remember this, though, and this is the story I'm working up to kind of introduce a transition. You'll see where I'm going in a second. Back to Tetzave. Very first business trip I remember taking. And, of course, when you traveled, we always had the three-piece suits on, and we would go to places where we were expected to dress up. I don't even remember where this trip was, to be honest with you, or what we were doing. But I was with the guy who became a really good friend over the years. He was a little senior to me at the point, kind of my one of my first mentors as an engineer. He had a couple of years on me when I was a brand new, you know, green behind the ears new hire. And we were someplace or other, and there was a place that we both wanted to go. And I remembered thinking and asking, can we go in there? Can we go in there or not? And, you know, the older engineer, he was, you know, probably all of 23, says to me, well, you know what? You can go anywhere in a three-piece suit. And we did. We walked back in there, and people looked at us, and a couple of them talked to us, but nobody bothered to stop you. You had a three-piece suit on. He was right. You can go anywhere in a three-piece suit. At least that was the case then. Nowadays, they probably think you need to be mugged or something if you're wearing something like that. Well, the point here is there is a there's an association of these special garments, set-apart garments, no less, for this particular office, for the Cohen. And it occurred to me as I was thinking about telling this story that, well, you know what, there is at least one place you cannot go in a three-piece suit, and that is into the Holy of Holies in the Mishkan. You better not go there at all. And clothes make the man, perhaps, but in this case, it's the high priest and it's his garments that matter. And there's a lot in this story that bears on that, and that's the part we'll kind of come back to. But I also want to throw this into the mix. A really interesting piece that I saw that makes a point about some of these words here. Some of them I had already thought about and was doing a little bit of looking into anyway. But I want to always give credit where it's due. This is a piece from Rabbi Ari Kahn entitled No Embarrassment. A deeper look at the meaning of the clothes that are described in this portion, Tetzaveh, and how does that apply to nakedness? Well, nakedness, I guess, is the opposite of being clothed in a way. So he points out that, look, we got the special treatment here for these special garments for Aaron and his sons, the Kohanim, and they're chosen for this role literally to minister as an intermediary between Elohim and the people who will be outside for the most part of the Mishkan. And the Torah describes in great detail, this portion, the various uniforms they're going to wear when they perform these holy tasks. Here's the key. This clothing is complex. It has a dual purpose. And when I look at things like that in Torah, it always kind of fascinates me. In other words, when you see all this detail and you know, well, there's no idle word in Torah, maybe there's more here than meets the eye. And it's not just about identifying, you know, clothes make the man, the position, title, or role of the person that's got it on. Certainly when you see somebody wearing this special outfit, you know, you knew not only that he was the Kohen Gadol, but he was fixing to do something very important as well, because he only wore these clothes for his, literally, yes, you say, for his job. And the other thing that this fellow points out, Rabbi Ari Kahn, clothing can either hide or obscure, too. All right, what's the point? Well, the words in the Hebrew here kind of make at least give us a hint at all this complexity. And I've already mentioned a couple of them. Set-apart garments. Beged is the singular form. Bigdei, plural. Bigdei Kodesh, it says, that are to be made for his Moshe's brother Aaron for dignity, for splendor, for kabod, and for adornment, or for beauty, le tifara. What's fascinating about this is that the root word there, that beged, actually is the very same root in the Hebrew as the word that is used to describe, you ready for this, betrayal, infidelity, disloyalty, or treason. Huh? Well, obviously, those aren't words that you would want to associate with the kind of clothing you're going to wear into the divine presence. And furthermore, in the next couple of verses, we're going to hear about some other things that the Torah tells us they will wear too. A garment called the me'il, the outer garment. And this one too, that word, me'il, has a root that's shared with another, he calls it a problematic concept. Me'ilah means embezzlement, misappropriation, sacrilege. So if anything, you would think me'ilah is kind of the antithesis of something associated with divine service that you want the Kohanim to be doing. Now, at this point, this fellow's thought process has kind of run in the same direction that mine did when I was going and looking up some of these garments. Because obviously one of the things you think is, well, okay, if we're going to talk about clothing with garments and we're looking at words that are getting used here, some of them for the first time, others we've seen before, a garment, raiment we've seen before a number of times. Well, when was the first time we saw that word used? Everybody remembers this one. Goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And this is where I think not only does the plot thicken, it gets downright fascinating. So, if you want to look at the Mishkan, suggests this fella, a place of purity and forgiveness, go back to that very first garment, maybe even just a tad further. After we see that Elohim creates a mate for Adam in the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, the Torah tells us they were both naked. They didn't have no clothes. And it says in Bereshit 2:25, both of them were naked, the man and his wife, his Isha, yet they felt no shame. Now in the Hebrew, that's lo yit boshashu. We'll come back to that. And this, it has been suggested, I like this, is described as, yeah, they were naked, they were nude, and yet, really, what we're talking about here isn't so much nakedness, they were merely unclothed. You get the difference? They were naked. They weren't ashamed. They didn't get that there was anything wrong with this. So it's not like they were naked so much as they were unclothed. Now, later, they're going to be naked. So, easily, says this fellow in laying out his thesis, you can imagine that Adam and Eve probably felt more vulnerable, more naked, even after they made those fig leaves and covered themselves up after their original sin. And probably they were more naked then than they actually were even when they were running around unclothed before, but when they had not committed an act worthy of being, well, exiled, kicked out, shellacked right out of the garden. So, after the Q&A session, and you know all of this, Genesis chapter 3, what happens? They're found guilty. They're going to get shellac. They're going to be sent away. But before they are evicted, here comes the key point, and this is going to connect. Yeah, trust me, we'll get there. Back to the Torah portion this evening. They are the beneficiaries, and I love this, they're the beneficiaries of an unanticipated gesture of compassion and kindness by their Creator, the Creator of the universe, heaven and earth, right? You could call it grace, unmerited favor. Which takes us back to those words that are used in the Hebrew. Okay, but let's talk about what happens first, because we do remember anyway. After Elohim made garments, not in this case out of fig leaves, but skins, something more durable for Adam and his wife. There's a lot you could say about the skins and, you know, what kind of skins were they? What kind of animal had to be sacrificed so that they could be clothed for what was coming? Anyway, he clothed them. He covered them. And that word there is vayal bishem. So that's the word that is used to describe the clothing fashioned for this couple that have now been disgraced, know they're naked, they know they are worthy of being exiled, which is what's going to happen to them. And I guess they're thankful they're still going to live for the rest of that more or less, not quite 1,000-year period. You have Vayal Bishem. That's the word that's been used to describe their innocent, unembarrassed nakedness before the sin. And then Yit Boshashu, both of which kind of draw on interrelated root forms. Now, there's some pretty inside Hebrew stuff here that I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on. But basically, the teacher here suggests that the subliminal message of these two words have to do with their earlier innocence when they were unclothed but not ashamed. And now, in his mercy and his grace, Elohim gives them, in effect, something to cover. There's that word that we see as beged, this idea of covering, raiment, to cover their nakedness, their shame, and it allows them to look away from their sin. So, he replaced those flimsy and not very sufficient fig leaves with something that was more sturdy and probably a lot warmer given where they were headed, which was out. And he judges them and then clothes them in forgiveness and restores at least some bit of dignity, even in exile. And in this verse, we see Elohim, Almighty, essentially the Elohim of judgment, as well as the name of Elohim, Yahuwah, as Shoftim, the judge. So, let's go back to where we're headed with all this and what it's got to do with the Mishkan, the clothes that Aaron and the other Kohanim are going to wear. It's not just about better or more appropriate attire. It's not just about the clothes make the man or it covers up nakedness or that kind of thing. The clothing, it is suggested, is an expression of Elohim's willingness to forgive. Let that sink in for a second. Is that still true here in the Mishkan? This is really special clothing. It's clothing that's going to be made for splendor and for beauty. Wow. At the same moment that Elohim hands down the sentence to Adam and Eve, he clothes them, he wraps them, he covers them in loving kindness. So yeah, kind of like a parent, right, has to chasten a wayward child. He cares for them even as he kicks them out, because they don't deserve to be there and they got something to learn. He kicks them out of Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, but he makes sure that they have proper clothing to protect them from the elements. They're given the clothing that they're going to need for the task that lies ahead. And all of this, he says, is a tangible reminder that Elohim cares for them even when they're in sin, even when they're in exile. The necessity, the reason they had to have this clothing, because they were guilty of bad behavior. And, oh, wait a second. Remember when we said this idea of beged has the same root as treachery and deceit? Clothing, covering, garment, raiment? Same root as treachery and deceit? Well, guess what? The clothing, in a very real sense, symbolizes the need for it because of their treachery, their treason, their dissent. The fact that they broke the one singular commandment, mitzvah, that Elohim had for them. It was a betrayal of trust. And furthermore, those other words that we talked about, me'ilah, embezzlement, misappropriation of the treasures that were put there for them in the garden, and their disregard for that singular command. On the other hand, the clothing that was made with loving care by a forgiving Elohim literally covers their embarrassment, covers their nakedness, eases their shame, and furthermore, again, is going to provide some measure of protection from the elements and from the pain and discomfort that would otherwise be associated with walking around in a considerably less forgiving place. And that is the key to this whole idea of the clothing for the Kohanim. And I guess you could say for the Mishkan as well. It has to do with not only the things that are obvious, a place for him to dwell among them, but also a continued reminder about the need for all of this because of that original failure in the garden, the fact that there is still this exile going on. And while it seems that, yeah, these people are now being delivered from slavery and bondage and are going to be going to the promised land, as we know, it ain't a done deal yet. There's still a lot to deal with. One other comment, I guess, as I was looking at this, because I saw this and thought this is kind of interesting. Remember, other places where we see the root, this word beged, and has the well, it's usually translated in the King James as raiment or garment. Think about the places we see in Genesis alone references to garments and ask, does this idea of Beged having at least an element of treachery and deceit, does that kind of play into the stories? Well, one of the places, right, fella named Judah, he's going to he's fixing to go out, do a little bit of travel with his bud, and they come across this, what looks like, to him anyway, a hooker. And she has covered herself with a garment that makes her look, and we're talking about Tamar, look like she's a lady of the evening. Of course, we know she's not, but there at least is a little bit of an element of deceit in all of this, and she does this because, well, Judah's been deceiving her. He was going to give her his youngest son. No such luck. All right, then the next time we see it is the story of Joseph. There's actually several references in the life of Joseph to rendering a, rending a garment, cutting it up, and you can think about where that happens, not only with the coat of many colors and what his dad does when he realizes that his son is dead, or at least he thinks he is. You have an adultery-minded woman, Potiphar's wife, who is intending to do the dirty deed with Joseph. What does she do? She snags his garment. His beged, takes it off of him and uses that very same raiment, to convict him unjustly of something he didn't do. And then, right, at the end of the story, the bookend for that particular little bit of beged, who is it? Well, none other than Pharaoh himself, who puts what? A particularly impressive bit of clothing on Joseph, more covering, to mark him as literally number two in the entire kingdom. So all of this is kind of neat, and I think it helps to look at these words and see the connections and realize, verse 2, why it is that we're to make set apart garments, that root word beged, for Aaron your brother, for splendor, for kabod, and for tifarah, le tifarah, for adornment. And further it says, speak to all these folks that are wise-hearted, ones I've filled with the spirit of wisdom, and they will make Aaron's garments to sanctify him, set him apart, so that he can minister to me in the office of the Kohen. In fact, the Kohen Gadol. These are the garments which you're going to make. And at this point, I'm going to do a little bit of something different than what I often do, and that is to kind of summarize a lot of the garmentry via some pretty interesting texts that I've used as a reference for a number of years. All right, I'll read verse 4. It says, here are the garments you're going to make, a breastplate and an ephod. That word doesn't even get translated, usually. I like the term ephod. And a robe and a tunic of checkered work, a miter and a girdle. You're going to make these holy garments for Aaron your brother and his son, so that he may minister to me in the office of the high priest, in the priest's office. And you're going to take this gold, blue, purple, and scarlet, and fine linen, and make these things. And then we're going to get a description of each one of them in order. How the shoulder cape, the ephod, is going to be made of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twine linen, the work of the skillful workman, and so forth. It's going to be in two pieces, going to be joined together, and all of that. Well, couple key points on this. One, the high priest is going to have described a total of 8 garments. The rest of the Kohanim, the kind of regular priests, if you will, had 4 required garments. And remember, they only wore these priestly garments while they were actually on the job, kind of like a police uniform or something. They wore them while they were performing their service. And we'll go through the 4 and then the remaining 4 in a different order, kind of this way. All the priests, all the regular Kohanim, wore the kutanet, a full-length tunic. It's kind of like a long shirt. Mishnah sayim, various undergarments. The migba'at, that was a band of white linen, was wound into a pointed turban that was on their head, and the avnet, which was a really long sash that was wound above the waist. And the text suggests to us that this avnet was over 60 feet long. We're talking about a lot of wrapping here. And in addition to that, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, of course, wore the garment we were just talking about when I paused for this digression. The ephod, it was an apron-like garment made of that blue, purple, and red-dyed wool, linen, and gold thread. The choshen mishpat, a breastplate, Now, when we see the pictures of the Kohen Gadol, you almost tend to kind of combine those two things, because if you see a picture of him or saw a rendering, a drawing of what it might look like, it looks like it's one piece, but it's actually two separate pieces. The breastplate is the item that has those 12 precious stones, each of which is inscribed with the names of one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And that is worn over the ephod, that two-piece construction, with a pouch. And the pouch contains these two stones. And the stones are described differently, but they're most famously known in the Hebrew as the Urim ve-Tumim. Urim ve, or and, Tumim. And they get translated into various things in the English, like, lights and eminences or something like that. But I like just the Hebrew term here, because really, the Hebrew is what matters, and we don't have anything equivalent to really talk about what they are anyway, much less how they're used, and we'll come back to that. These two stones were used to literally discern, to get a direct feedback on the will of Elohim. All right, item number 7, the Me'il Techelet, a robe of blue wool with golden bells and decorative pomegranates on its hem, on its H-E-M, not H-Y-M-N, and the Zitz, a golden headband that wore a particular inscription that almost all of us can probably remember, which is Kadosh Le Yahuwah, holy, separate, unto Yahuwah. And if you look at all these garments, you notice that there's one obvious thing that they're missing, and that is shoes, slippers, sandals. In other words, they served in the Mishkan and later in the temple barefoot. All right, there's lots of reasons for describing the bells, right? And lots of jokes that go with the bells around the hymn. But there is a reference in the text that says, so that they do not die. And I guess if the bells quit ringing, that's an indication that something went wrong. I'll come back to, let me see if there's anything in here in particular that I want to make sure I don't miss in the text as we go through it. We've kind of described the construction a little bit of these garments. I won't go into all of the details, but it does talk in verse 8 and 9 about these two stones, two onyx stones, and they'll have engraved on them, six on one, six on the other, the names of the children of Israel, the names of the various tribes. And then furthermore, we're going to have, after these this piece is put together, the breastplate of judgment, the work of the skillful workman, it too is going to be four square and doubled. A span will be the length of it, and a span the breadth of it. And in it is going to be these settings of stones, four rows of stones. So four rows of three, basically. And this is where we'll go back, and it's kind of interesting. You look at the Hebrew words there, and quite honestly, the Hebrew doesn't mean a whole lot less than some of the English words do. I might recognize a topaz to see it. Honestly, not so much a carbuncle or a carnelian or a jacinth. There's others in here that I would recognize, but some of those, I guess I'm just not that expert of a gems person to know. But in any case, here's how this is said to work. We have in the first row, Reuben, tribe of Reuben, a ruby. The topaz represents the tribe of Simeon. And then the Garfinkel, there's another one. And that's another one of these words even in the English. I think there's probably multiple ways to translate that. It's not Arthur Garfunkel. It's Garfinkel that represents Levi. Judah by a carbuncle. Issachar by a sapphire. Well, a sapphire at least I'd recognize to see it. Zebulon, a pearl. Dan, a jacinth. Naphtali, an agate. Gad just says a crystal, because some of these we honestly really aren't sure what they are. Generally, that means quartz, I would think, some kind of quartz. But, of course, a lot of precious stones are one kind or another quartz. Depending on what the other minerals are that are in there, it changes the color. In the fourth and final row, we have Asher, which is an emerald. Okay, we know what that is. Joseph, an onyx, and Benjamin, the Yasneh. And here, for Benjamin's stone, basically the translators recognize that we're not sure what that is. And there's a little bit of lore that goes into here. I'll just mention this because sometimes it's kind of fascinating, even if it's not necessarily scriptural. There was a, the Midrash claims that there was a particularly amazing worm called a shamir. It was a tiny little thing, about the size of a grain of barley. And this was how the names were actually engraved on the stone. This little worm would actually engrave the names on the stone. Well, anyway, whether we can prove that or not, it's kind of interesting. At this point, I'll do this. I'll pause because I don't normally go into quite so much detail, but this is a Torah portion where there is a lot of detail, and just see if there's any questions that people have. While I'm thinking of it, one other commentary that usually gets pointed out is, well, gee, how exactly? And the truth of the matter is, we're not 100% sure. I've heard various explanations over the years. After a while, you say, well, the one that I hear often and most often probably at least has an element of truth in it. But the Urim Vetumim and the these 12 stones arranged in three rows of four or four rows of three. Somehow or other, that was used in order to discern the will of Elohim. And the general understanding is that somehow or other, a question was asked. It was usually said to be a single question. We see this, by the way, in the book of Samuel, with David doing it frequently. And at least one point where Saul would like to do it, but he's missing some of the pieces, and he's kind of on the outs anyway, doesn't work for him. But David would use these to discern the will, and he would ask questions, and he would get an answer. And obviously, if you have the two stones, you could use one for yes and one for no, and that's one of the ways that it's generally thought to have perhaps worked. Although there are more, let's just say esoteric claims that these stones would actually light up and would shine upon the names of the children of Israel, and that there are 72 letters, of course, represented in these various names, and that somehow or other all kinds of more complex information could be relayed that way. So bottom line, even if we're not sure, somehow or other it does seem like this particular garment or description of a set of garments that made up the outfit for the high priest had almost like a, well, I don't want to, had a communicator effect. It was like a communicator. I'll read verse 30 as we move on. You shall put, it says, in the breastplate of judgment the Urim ve-Tumim, and they shall be upon Aaron's heart when he goes in before Yahuwah, and Aaron shall bear the judgment of the B'nai Israel al levo, all upon his heart, his lev, before Yahuwah continually. Make the robe of the ephod out of all blue. Basically, it's going to have a hole for his head to go in there, and it's going to have the skirts, and we've talked about some of this with the pomegranates and the bells. On his head, he wears that that particular label, that identifying plate of pure gold, engraven with the words, Kadosh Le Yahuwah. And put on the thread of blue and upon the mitre, and it's on the forefront of the mitre. And Aaron is to wear this on his forehead. He bears the iniquity committed in the holy things, which the children of Israel shall hallow, even in all their holy gifts, and it is always to be upon his forehead, that they might be accepted before Yahuwah. Now here I pause, okay? Forehead, forehead, forehead. Why do we hear that? Had a discussion just over the last couple days, seems like several times, about elements of things that people see in the book of Revelation. And my comment, and I contend, essentially, people want to try to read the so-called New Testament, and they say, oh, I don't need the Old Testament, I don't need any of that old stuff, it's all done away with anyway. Wrong, sorry. And I contend fairly forcefully, you're not going to understand almost any of it, to be honest. But in particular, you turn to that final book, the Revelation, you don't have a clue what the symbolism is there unless you understand some of the things, the line by line, precept by precept, here a little, there a little, that is built up from the rest of the book, starting from Bereshit, Genesis, all the way to the end, through maps. But without the foundation, right, when the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? And if you don't understand the concept of something that is engraven upon the high priest's head, Kadosh Le Yahuwah, forehead, 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 well, what is it about this mark of the beast on somebody's right hand or forehead Do we get a clue about, maybe there's a counterfeit here? Maybe people are supposed to recognize that it's the opposite again. Lots of contrasts in Scripture that's being described. A mark that separates the Kohen Gadol, are we supposed to be? Well, at least this is what churchianity will tell people. Oh, you want to be a high priest and a king on the order of Melchizedek? Doesn't it make sense that if that's the case, we ought to at least know a little bit about what the priest and the Kohen, what their job is and what the job of the duties of a king are? That's all described for us right here. Does make sense that the clothing is important. Now, we're told, well, we don't need this clothing anymore. Well, you know what, folks? We're still in exile. Again, we're still in this place where we need the covering. We need his covering. And if we want to throw all of this out and pretend it doesn't matter anymore, hey, I said that prayer once and done, right? I think we're missing a whole lot. Let me read the last verse in chapter 28. After all these garments are described, next to last one here, next to last verse, make them some linen breeches to cover the flesh of their nakedness. From their loins to the thighs, that's how long they go. Cover their nakedness. Okay, well, we've kind of already touched on that. These are to be upon Aaron, upon his sons, when they go into the tent of meeting, or when they come near to the altar to minister in the set-apart place, the place that is Kadosh, so that they do not bear iniquity and die. That sounds kind of serious, doesn't it? This too, it says, shall be a statute forever unto him and unto his seed after him. Chapter 29, going to talk about the ordination of the priest and the daily offerings. A lot of things that are going to be done. And how it is that the priest's office is going to be set apart and hallowed. And a lot of this sounds like a process we've seen referenced, and at least similar processes in another place. Take one young bull, two rams without blemish, unleavened bread, cakes mingled with oil, wafers, unleavened, spread with oil, fine wheaten flour, they're to be made. And you put them into a basket, and bring them in the basket, along with the bull and the two rams, and Aaron and his sons shall bring them under the door of the tent of meeting, wash themselves with water. Take the garments, put upon Aaron the tunic, the robe, the ephod, the breastplate, gird him with the skillfully woven band of the ephod, set the mitre upon his head, put the holy crown upon the mitre, and then, gonna anoint him. Pour this upon his head. Now, what is this anointing? Right? That word there, anointed one, of course, is Mashiach. One who is anointed. Lots of folks in the Scripture, besides the one that's referred to as HaMashiach, not necessarily the just this particular Mashiach, that would be the definite article, but in particular the one that we're expecting, that prophet like unto Moshe. But remember, there are a lot of anointed ones, Aaron among them. Put this oil, pour it upon his head. Bring his sons, put their tunics, gird them all up with all the other things, those four items that they wear. Bring the bull in the tent of meeting. Aaron and his sons lay their hands upon its head and kill it at the door. Take the blood, put that blood upon the horns of the altar, pour out the remaining blood at the base of the altar. And then there's a description of what they're going to do with all the fat and the lobes upon the liver, and they'll be made to smoke upon the altar. They will go up in smoke, literally. The flesh of the bull, though, that gets to go outside the camp. It's a sin offering. Take the one ram, Aaron and his son shall lay their hands upon that one. They slay the ram, take its blood, dash it around against the altar, cut the ram into pieces, wash it, and make the whole thing, the ram, smoke upon the altar, a burnt offering unto Yahuwah, sweet savor, an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. There's a phrase we're going to see many, many times. Take the other ram. Aaron and his sons lay their hands upon that one. So the concept here, and this is a repeated theme too, they put their hands upon the head of the animal that is literally going to perish to be sacrificed for the process here. Kill that one, take its blood, put it upon three places on Aaron. This is a consistent pattern too. His right ear, tip of the right ear, and this is going to happen for his sons too, upon the thumb of his right hand, and the big toe of his right foot. So you got right earlobe, right thumb, right big toe. Dash the blood against the altar. And some of the blood, actually, the part that's remaining and the anointing oil, gets sprinkled upon Aaron, upon his garments, and his sons. They're to be hallowed. Take the ram, the fat tail, and all those kind of things. It's a ram of concentrate of consecration. One loaf of bread, one cake of oiled bread, one wafer. And out of the basket of this bread that's before Yahuwah, put the whole thing into Aaron's hands and the hands of his sons, and they're to be made a wave offering. They literally wave them before Yahuwah. Take them from their hands, and then make them smoke upon the altar. Another sweet savor before Yahuwah, offering made by fire. Take the breast of Aaron's ram of consecration, wave it before Yahuwah. It is to be, it says, to Moshe, your portion. Sanctify the breast of the wave offering, the thigh of the heave offering, which is waved, even that which is Aaron's and of that which is his sons. And this is to be a due for Aaron and his sons forever. Literally, this is their portion. This is going to be one of those things that will be the due, the rightful gift, I guess you would say, from the congregation unto the Kohanim. The holy garments, these things that Aaron is wearing here and thereafter, and for his sons, they'll be anointed in them and consecrated in them. 7 days they do this, and this applies to those who come into the tent of meeting in the holy place. And then it describes what happens to these sacrifices, the rest of the process here. Do these things, it says, unto Aaron and his sons, according to all that I have commanded you. 7 days they're to be consecrated, and each day you offer the bull of the sin offering besides these other offerings of atonement. You do the purification upon the altar. So it's a complicated, involved procedure. 7 days you make atonement for the altar to sanctify it. It is most kadosh. Anyone who touches it ought to be holy, set apart. And here's what you're going to do now from here on out, at least as long as there is a Mishkan and later a temple. 2 lambs offered of the first year, day by day, continually. One in the morning and the other at dusk. And along with the lambs, 1/10 of a part of an ephah, fine flour, mingled with 1/4 part of a hin of beaten oil, and some wine, 1/4 part of a hin of wine for a drink offering. So that happens at basically at the first part of the day, in the morning, and then there is an offering of another lamb at dusk with a meal offering, sweet savor. It's a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tent of the meeting, and there, he says, Yahuwah, will I meet with you to speak with you. And I'll meet with the children of Israel, and the tent, the ohel, will be sanctified by my glory. Oh, wait, there's that word, kabod, kabodi, mine. My glory. And I'll sanctify the tent of meeting and the altar, Aaron and his sons too. They'll be set apart so they can minister to me in the priest's office. And I will dwell among the B'nai Israel and will be their Elohim. And it says, they shall know Ki Ani Yahuwah that brought them forth out of the land of Mitzrayim, so I can dwell among them Ki Ani Yahuwah Eloheichem. Now, the last chapter is going to talk in these last few verses about an altar of acacia wood. It's a cubit by a cubit, 4 square, 2 cubits high, and it's got horns that are made of one piece with it. It, too, like other things we've seen described in the furnishings for the Mishkan, is made, overlaid, with pure gold. Top, sides, round about the horn. And 2 golden rings, and on the 2 ribs on the 2 sides. So it is also kind of like the ark, the aron. It's going to be carried with these staves of acacia wood that are also overlaid with gold. The portion ends this way. You put this last altar before the ark of the testimony, before the ark cover. That is where I will meet with you. This is the altar of incense, of course. And Aaron will burn on this altar incense of sweet spices. Every morning, when he dresses the lamps, he burns it. When he lights the lamps at dusk, he burns it. Perpetual incense before Yahuwah, again, throughout your generations. Don't put any strange incense thereon, or different kinds of burnt offerings, or meal offerings, nor drink offerings. This is for Aaron to make atonement upon the horns of it once a year. With the blood of the sin offering of atonement, once a year shall he make atonement for it throughout your generations. It is Kadosh, Kadoshim, Le Yahuwah. Most set apart. Set apart, set apart. Unto Yahuwah. And with that, the portion ends. So, again, one of those kind of fascinating portions. To some extent, yeah, we look at it and go, okay, a whole lot of detail about garments that were probably very impressive at one time. We don't have them anymore, can't see them. What does it mean? We don't get to hear from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in the same way. Well, people will say, well, we hear better now. I'm not sure by looking at the world that we hear at all. But you sure wish that these people that think of themselves as kings or gods or whatever they think of themselves would actually listen to the Creator. And the idea of the high priest and having his Urim ve-Tumim does seem to be lost on an entire world now that could care less what the Creator has to say, even though they may lie to us and tell us they're listening.